My text for this morning is almost a pretext, but I'll have you turn to it just the same. Galatians 2:20. Having committed one crime, I'll commit another. I'm going to be very ungrammatical in announcing the topic. But first the verse. I am crucified with Christ. Nevertheless I live, yet not I, but Christ liveth in me. And the life which I now live in the flesh, I live by the faith of the Son of God, who loved me and gave himself for me. Three little words. Not I, but. Not I, but. I don't think I need to warn you that the days in which we are living are dark. I believe personally they are the very days that the Apostle Paul spoke about when he said, in the last days perilous times shall come. And the word perilous there could be translated exceeding fierce. And we can see that there is a new development, if such it can be called, in these protest meetings that are going on all over the country. If you don't think the world's gone crazy, well then I do. And if I'm alone, I'll say it again. The world's gone crazy. One cannot dare take sides in this matter, and one doesn't wish to, but one can think and do a lot of thinking. But I'm doing a lot of thinking this morning along another line. I am appalled. And I am distressed over the apparent unconcern of the average Christian for his own spiritual welfare. I know in many places the emphasis is upon soul saving, and I'm not criticizing that. But I do say that these people, we need to know something of what God has in store for us. The Apostle Paul could say, not I, but Christ. What do we say? What does the average Christian say? Not I, but. And he fills it in with almost anything but the word that the apostle uses. And I believe that this morning, most of you, I won't say all of you, but I would like to say all of you, are aware of the situation that the apostle Paul calls for in these marvelous prison epistles, showing us the tremendous heights to which we have been called and chosen, the tremendous heights which are ours yet to be because of that call and choice. But I am concerned, and I wish today that I have the privilege and the opportunity of speaking to 10 million professing Christians, because I think they need it more than you do, probably. And yet there is a word here for every heart. I don't know whether you noticed what I read this morning, and perhaps wondered a little why I happened to choose that particular portion. But twice at least in this passage that I read in chapter 10 of 1 Corinthians, Paul says, now these things were for our examples. And I know it was written for the Corinthian people, but the examples still stand in connection with our subject this morning. I believe that we can take Israel, as Paul has taken it here, to show us just what I have in mind with regard to this message, not I, but. Did you ever stop to realize that the movement of Israel from Egypt into the promised land was in three stages? Three definite, precise stages that marked off their typical spiritual life. And because of this, I just want to deal with it as we may make application to our own hearts. First of all, in the case of the children of Israel, you remember that they were in bondage in Egypt. They had labored for years. And with the coming of another Pharaoh, the burdens had been laid upon them so heavily that they groaned in spirit and called out to Jehovah for deliverance. It would seem that the ear of Jehovah was deaf. But it wasn't. Jehovah was working first of all in a little babe hidden in the bulrushes. An accident? A coincidence? or a divine overruling. For he was taken out of the bulrushes to live in the palace of Pharaoh. Hardly a coincidence, more likely a miracle. And there we read that Moses was learned in all the wisdom of the Egyptians, and as the adopted son of Pharaoh's daughter, he could be and probably was in line for the rulership of that great country. And remember that at that time, Egypt was the great power in the world. It's no good thinking them as an ignorant people. They were not. And so when we say that he was learned in all the wisdom of the Egyptians, he was no ignorant man. He was a wise man. He was a man that could have ruled the world had circumstances not been different. A little incident happens in the life of this man. Again, it seems like a coincidence. And the result of that was that he fled into the wilderness. If I may make a little digression from what I have in mind, yet I do believe there is a point here for you and for me. 40 years, listen to this, beloved, 40 years of his life spent in being someone, in becoming someone. Schooled in all the sciences. Destined to reign. And then this trivial incident. Not trivial in a sense, and yet, with death in those days being as they were, one man's life wasn't counted very much. But it was that one man's life, and what happened as a result sent him out into the wilderness where for 40 years he was learning to be a no one. Beloved, do you stop to realize that as with Moses, so with you and with me? What I'm trying to say is this, that God has more difficulty getting us to be a no one than a someone. And until we are a no one, we can never be very much use to him. And so there in the backside of the wilderness, he learned precious lessons. And then, in the third 40 years of his life, he wasn't a someone, but he was a servant of God, a deliverer of his people, and he led them out of Egypt. Now that's the first stage of their life. They were led out of Egypt. Now, there was something marvelous about the way in which God ordained all this. Sometimes it looks as if God takes an awful circuitous route to get here. We could say, well, the shortest line is the straightest. But God often goes way, way, way round to bring us to that point. And you have a sample here. When he took them out of Egypt, it was 11 days' journey into the promised land. How many years did it take them? 2 they never got there at all. Only 2. And it took them 37 and a half years. 11 days. You say, well, where's the wisdom of God in that? Why didn't he take them straight in? Well, let's suffer the Lord to know a little more about these people than we do. Let's suffer the Lord to know a little more about us than we do. And God has a reason for these circuitous routes, these detours. Now, the first stage of their experience is redemption by substitution. They were redeemed, they were delivered, they were taken out of the land of bondage, they were taken out from under the hand of their persecutors. How? Symbolically, by the shed blood upon the doorposts and the lintel of every home. And you remember how God said, when I see the blood, I will what? Pass over you. For even the destroying angel would pass over that place. That home would not be touched. And I'd like to make a suggestion here. It's not in the scriptures, but I think the scriptures would support it. And that is this, that had an Egyptian known of this, and had the Egyptian taken up the blood of a lamb and put it upon his doorpost, the eldest son in that home would have likewise have been saved, or typically redeemed. For God will honor the blood wherever he sees it. By the same token, if an Israelite failed to put the blood upon the doorpost, he couldn't count on the other homes as covering his. He had to do it for his own son, for the firstborn in his home. So they were redeemed. Don't you see that there is an application? There is a beautiful picture. You and I, according to Ephesians 2, we might just as well glance at it in case you have forgotten and I couldn't quote it, so I'm reading it. And you hath he quickened who were what? Dead in trespasses and sins, wherein in time past ye walked, according to the course of this age, according to the prince of the power of the air, and the spirit that now worketh in the sons of disobedience, among whom we all had our conversation in times past, and so on. If that doesn't speak of a spiritual Egypt, I don't know what you want in the way of examples and types. And how were we delivered? It tells you in chapter 1:7 of Ephesians again. I'm not going to any other portion, for it's all here. Ephesians 1:7, just a moment. In whom we have redemption through his blood, the forgiveness of sins. So we are redeemed through the shed blood of Christ. We have been brought out from our spiritual Egypt. Will you read Colossians 1 now? Anybody said the gospel of the grace of God isn't in these prison epistles, got another thing coming. Chapter 1, verse 12. Giving thanks unto the Father, which hath made us meet to be partakers of the inheritance and the holiest of all in the light, who hath delivered us from the power of darkness and hath translated us into the kingdom of his dear Son. Is this a deliverance parallel to that of the Israelites in Egypt? Is there a likeness here? Delivered from the authority of darkness? Were they delivered from the authority of Pharaoh? Yes, and there the parallel ceases. You can't make this a parallel, because here in Colossians and Ephesians, we are taken into something so marvelously above all this that God couldn't even put it in type, what he's prepared for us. Do you know why he couldn't put it in type? Because the mystery was a mystery. The mystery was a secret hidden from ages and from generations and was hidden in God. He couldn't make a type of it. People say they can see a type of the church in the Old Testament. I challenge them to find it. They just got the wrong church, that's all. Oh, beloved, it's wonderful to be saved in this particular dispensation. But now notice, we must go on because of the time. After they had gotten out of Egypt, what was the problem? God had got them out of Egypt, but he hadn't been able to get Egypt out of them. How do I know? Well, they come down to the Red Sea, a redeemed people. And the minute they are confronted with a problem, they begin to cry. And we're trapped. Bless your heart, the God that got them out of Egypt can surely keep them out of Egypt. And not let them be taken back by Pharaoh's army. Once saved, always saved. Any fear of going back to Egypt? Well, that's one side of the question, but it wasn't their problem. A little later on, you remember, Moses had gone up into the mount and they said, we don't know what's happened to this fellow. Let's make us gods and let us go back. Let's go back to the leek, from the garlic, and the onions. Smells a little to me. It really does. You see, Egypt was still here. When Lot and his wife came out of Sodom, she never really came out. Her body came out, but her mind and her spirit and her heart was back. So that she turned and looked back, and that was as good as going back. She was judged immediately for it. And so we go on, until at last, under the providence of God, you remember how he provided water for them, he provided food for them, he provided clothing for them. As a matter of fact, the clothing stayed with them. I don't think you ladies would have liked that very much. Fancy wearing the same clothes for 40 years. The same shoes. Well, I'm sure Saks of New York couldn't have got along very well in those days. They'd have been bankrupt. But you see, there was no other way in which they could be provided for, and so God works the miracle. And they are clothed, and they are fed, and they are brought up to Kadesh Barnea. Now, at the Kadesh Barnea, another crisis happens. And it's the crisis that is happening today in the minds and the hearts and the lives of so many Christians that is pathetic. And what was that? Well, there's a question in many people's minds as to whether Moses was justified in sending in the 12 spies. If God had brought them to that place, couldn't he have taken them the rest of the way without their investigation? We'll leave that open. The point is this, that the 12 come back and there is a minority report that says we are well able to overcome them. And they listen to, did I say majority or minority? Well, the majority says no, they're like giants. We can't go in. What was the result? What was the result? Yes, but before that, now this is the tragedy. He says, we can't go in. God says, all right, then you'll die in the wilderness. We will go in. And they made an attempt to go in. And they failed. If that isn't human nature, if that isn't the old man rearing his ugly head. See? Now what we are dealing with here is this. I am crucified. Nevertheless, I live. But, not I, but Christ. And what God was seeking to show us Christians down through the ages, through these people, is that before they could enter into the promised land, that old attitude had to be left on this side Jordan. Couldn't take it over. So he says, you'll die in the wilderness. Now, what was it that kept them from going in? Their weakness? Their unbelief. Just think of it, 40 years, marking time on death. Nowhere to go. Listen, beloved, I can see hundreds of Christians today who are doing just that. They're marking time, wandering around and around in the Word, getting nothing out of it. It's a painful duty to read it. They don't like praying. They don't like prayer meeting. They don't like services. They cut it down to the minimum. Why? They're not happy. And why aren't they happy? Because they've been nastily saved. That's a nice expression. They've been nastily saved. They have been saved so as by the skin of their teeth. You wonder whether they've really been saved at all, but these people were saved, so we'll grant the benefit of the doubt. The trouble is, they did not want to go on. And these Christians of today, they're satisfied with a simple gospel. They're satisfied with just getting into the kingdom, as they call it. But meeting the gracious purpose of God for the life, and instead of having their eyes on the future, and I mean now eternity, with what God wants to do with us who have been chosen from and before the ages, from eternity, for eternity, what he wants to do with us here and now in the light of that. Now these people, they didn't want to see the promised land. They didn't want to enter it because they'd heard enough about it to scare them to death. And I know dozens of Christians that will not look into the teaching that you and I are privileged to enjoy because they're scared to death of it. And why? Because some bogeyman has come around and said, that's awful. That's awful. That's satanic. That's satanic. Well, listen, beloved, if this is satanic, then the Satan has been converted because this teaching glorifies my Lord. This teaching exalts him above any teaching. And if this is of Satan, then it's the most remarkable thing in the universe. Satanic, is it? I tell you, dear friends, those people, whoever they are, I don't care where they stand in the scale of clever men and Bible scholars, if they dare to call this teaching satanic, they've got to answer to God for this truth, believe you me. If God was careful to deal with these people in their attitude toward his truth, I know the people that decry the teaching of the mystery are going to have to stand before him and give an account. Now then, let's go on. I say these people, they didn't want to go in. And so what? Their unbelief has kept them out and they get nowhere. And I believe, dear friends, that you can take it from me when anyone, I don't care where it is in this scale of spiritual understanding, when you stop believing God and refuse to go on, there is no more light for you. Now you can check that out in people's lives. and see those who have turned their back on the truth. Now this was the second aspect. And I was saying before that here, God has a difficulty in getting these people to do it. Now look at the type. What happens in the type? The whole nation representing those that came out from Egypt, saved, that whole nation dies. And there is a new generation that comes up that goes in. The old man has to die before we can cross our spiritual Jordan. Do you get it? Do you see it? Is it against circumstance? Is it again coincidence that there were two baptisms for this people? There was a baptism that we read of in 1 Corinthians 10, where it says they were baptized into Moses in the sea and in the cloud. Was that a baptism? Well, when you come to the Jordan, don't you get another one? If these people were baptized as they went through the Red Sea, then they were baptized again as they went through Jordan. But it was a new race. It was the new man, if you use the typology. Have you been baptized into Christ? Or which baptism are you going to choose? You're not going to choose any. He made the choice. And he told me and he told you in Romans 6. You better look at that, lest I misquote it. Romans 6. What shall we say then? Shall we continue in sin that grace may abound? God forbid. How shall we that are dead to sin live any longer therein? Know ye not that so many of us as were baptized into Jesus Christ were baptized into his what? How much plainer can God make it? Therefore we are what? Now let me ask you a question. I know it's a little facetious, but let me ask you this question. How many people that have been baptized in water have been baptized alive? You know what I mean? Of course they were baptized alive. They would come out as they might have drowned. But I mean they never knew the spiritual meaning of baptism, even if they applied to water baptism. And that is that they were dead before they were buried. We don't bury people alive unless it's some atrocious thing in Vietnam or somewhere else. We usually wait till people die and then give them a decent burial and say the nicest things about them that we wouldn't say when they were alive. How strange we are. Now then, don't you see the point? This second baptism at Jordan, there is a difference. The baptism into Moses in the sea and in the cloud is a twofold baptism. I don't care what other people say. In the sea represented the Red Sea, did it not? And the cloud, what did that represent? The Shekinah glory that went before them. They were baptized into the cloud, which many take to represent the Holy Spirit. They were baptized in the water in the sea. You don't find that recorded in the Jordan experience. It's just one baptism. But the difference is this. In the Moses baptism, they did nothing at all except sleep. Whilst they were sleeping, God blew with his wind and the channel was made and they walked through it the next day. But when they get down to Jordan, what happens? God says, take the priests, one out of every tribe. And he's to take a stone from this side Jordan. Now, if this is something crazy, doesn't parallel the fall of Jericho, then look again. What's this idea of taking a stone from one side, putting it in the riverbed, and then taking another stone that has been in the riverbed all its aeons and aeons of centuries and ages, and put it out on the other side? It doesn't mean anything. Now, what does it mean? Well, the first thing is they take the stone from this side Jordan. That's where they've been living for 40 years. Now, what about the water? You've got to take that into consideration. God didn't say, well now tonight when you go to sleep, I'm going to blow with my winds again. He says, when the priests dip their feet in the river Jordan, which is overflowing its banks, mark you, then I'll what? Now, does that call for an element of faith on the part of these men? Sure it does. And so the priests went and they dipped their feet in, and immediately God works. And way up at a place called Sin, I won't go into that, but is that typical? At a place called Sin, the waters are held back. Now they put this stone in, they take another stone out, and on the other side they build a little memorial with it. Listen, beloved, in type, this is the old life going in. The baptism is going to cover it. They're coming out the other side in the new life. Now, instead of doing that with human life, he did it with stones. But it was an act of faith. And beloved, I put myself in Romans 6. I have been baptized into Christ. I have been crucified. Not that I've done it. He did it. When did he do it? He did it when Christ died. When Christ died, he reckoned his people that he had chosen before the foundation of the world. If he can choose you before, he can certainly put you with Christ there. No problem. And those who died with Christ were buried with him and were raised together with him. Now listen, I haven't got time to go into all of the ramifications of this message. I wanted to deal with it with Israel. I wanted to deal with it with the people that we're going to call the Pentecostal Church, the Acts Period Church. I wanted to take this message and its relationship to the church, which is his body. I'm going to cut that short by saying this. One of the marvels of our day is this, that when God put me and you into this position of being dead and buried and raised together with him, he did something more. And this is the transcendent glory of our calling. He did what? He raised us to what? Or maybe I should put it another way. He raised us to where? Not to what, but to where? At his own right hand. Is that something marvelous? Beloved, if anyone ought to appreciate these truths and teachings, we did. Because the same truth holds for us as for these. And so it was that there was this time of wandering around in the wilderness. And my heart, I come back to it again, my heart is disturbed because so many people are not interested. They don't want God's best. They interpret God's best as something else. The spiritual life. Well, that's a good thing. But God's best is to see, first of all, where our spiritual life is to be lived. Does he say, set your affections on things above? Does he say, and not on things on the earth? And why does he say that? For your life is hid with Christ. Well, where is Christ? And where is God? Far above all. So we're back again. And yet we go on living, seeking the things that are down here. Galatians 2. Not I, but. Oh, I'd like to go on with Christ, but you know, it costs too much. I lost a lot of friends way back. I can't afford to lose anymore. Oh, I'd like to sing that little hymn to such people. What a friend we have in Jesus. Are you going to put his friendship up against the friendship of human creatures or anything else? Now notice, we must close with this. Third thought. There's the two stages. We've had the stage where they were redeemed. We have the stage where they became wanderers. They had no appetite for the things of God. They couldn't even go back into Egypt. Listen, they were spoiled for both places. And the Christian that won't go on with God is the most unhappy person in the world. And I've often likened them to a horseback rider who is in a circus and he's got two horses. And he's riding one foot on one and one on the other. And suddenly these horses taken into their heads, they're going different ways. What's he going to do? Well, he doesn't have to get on one or the other or go down in between. Another way of putting it is straddling the fence. You can't walk the fence, beloved. It's got to be one side or the other. All out or not. Why it is that people can't go all out for the truth of God is understandable in a way because of the experience of these people. I won't go back to the examples that Paul gave us, but it's a terrible thing. It seems almost unbelievable. I'll just glance at one because it may be a problem in your mind. Did you notice what Paul said there in 1 Corinthians 10 that seemed to be perfectly harmless? Listen. Neither, verse 7, 1 Corinthians 10, neither be ye idolaters as were some of them, as it is written, the people sat down to eat and drink and they rose up to play. Poor souls, what else could they do in the wilderness? At least that's what you might think. But behind this is the next verse. Neither let us commit fornication, as some of them committed and fell in one day 23,000, or 23,000. That was what they did when they rose up to play after the eating and drinking and the debauchery. Well, I know this. We may not take that verse literally, but I believe there is a lot of spiritual immorality that's going on. An unchastity on the part of God's people. An unholiness and an unclean living that's comparable to this. Well, now let's come to the brighter side of the picture, the third stage. There were those that went in. And again, it seems to me that God has gone out of his way to try and make this lesson clear. Can you tell me, please, what was the first thing they did when they got on other side, Jordan? You read Joshua lately? You know what? I think it would be good for it, because there are a good many Bible teachers that says that Joshua is the Ephesians of the Old Testament. Oh, no, long before they took Jericho. What did they do the moment they got over? Well, I haven't got the actual verse, but I'll... Nope. Yes, well, that we've seen as a part of the coming across. Now, after that, what was the first thing they do? Well, it's not a nice thing to talk about, but the very first thing that God commanded that nation was that they should be circumcised. The cutting off of the flesh, this old attitude again concerning the flesh. And it was a symbol, and it was the circumcision that made Abraham to understand something, that they were a separated people. And so it was that that was the very first thing that was done before they started on for Jericho and their conquest of the land. In other words, they entered into a life of victory, but which was based upon the matter of faith. Was it faith that brought down Jericho, or was it the sword? Of course, it was God that did it, but on their side, what? Faith that leads to obedience, and I don't think we have the right to call it faith if it doesn't issue in obedience. And there was a renunciation, in a sense, of all that which was worldly, earthly, strategy of earth. They left it alone because God says we've got another way of doing it. I know later on they resort to the sword, but all these lessons were designed to show them this one thing. It was not by might nor by power, but by my spirit, saith the Lord. It was also to show them that the old nature that we've been talking about could not win the victory. Not I, but Christ liveth in me. And the life that I now live, I live by the faith of the Son of God, who loved me and gave himself for me. And in the church which is his body, there is the need for us to go on living that ascended life. I don't know, I may have to carry this over till next week, because I want to bring together some passages dealing with our position in Christ and what is involved. Now, it's all very well for us to keep talking about being blessed with all spiritual blessings. It's all very well to talk about being raised and seated with Christ. But what about the practical outworking of these things? We need to know these and then to walk in them.